Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Danson.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is world-class backgammon player Bob Wachtel. We last spoke to Bob in June of last year about his original book on ace point games. In this show and next, we're going to cover three books he's published since that original work, an update to the ace point game book, and a two-book set called The Backgammon Chronicles, A Prose Adventure on Tour. Bob Wachtel, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Hello, gentlemen.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, the version of your ace point game that we discussed last time, it's called In the Game Until the End, came out in 2000, although an earlier version existed in some form. 14 years later, you came out with volume 2 of the same book, which starts out with some relatively small corrections to what you published before. What had changed in the world of backgammon that made you come out with volume 2?
Well, let me just correct something. Although the version of In the Game Until the End that you are referring to does say on its copyright 2000, it really hadn't materially changed from the original. The original was written in 1993, and that was before the advent of artificial intelligence programs, which programs have completely changed the backgammon scene. So the work that I did on In the Game Until the End in 1993 was all done by hand. Which means that I did a bunch of actual arithmetic, and then I did some what we call rollouts in the backgammon world, which means you take the position and you play it out until the end over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. It's sort of a lonely business, although you can do it with other people. And you get some feeling for the equities of the position. So I'd done that in 1993, and I had anticipated or envisioned writing a second volume very soon. But around 1995-96, the first successful artificial intelligence program called Jellyfish came out, and I saw that I was immediately had become a dinosaur. These programs are much smarter than human beings, and they do things thousands of times faster than human beings can do them. So I just figured, oh well, you know, at least you know, my 1993 book can look like a bit of an historical artifact. You could put it in a time capsule or something like that, and people will look at it 100 years from now or 1,000 years from now, and you know, laugh that somebody had to do all this calculation and work by hand. And so I just left it there for years and years, and I thought that there would be lots and lots of books like this, just because they're so easy to do now, so much more easy. You can just ask the computer and it'll do a lot of calculations for you, and then you can supplement that with a few remarks. During the years after 1993 until, you know, the early 2000s or 2010 or so, people would every once in a while come by and say, well, you know, what's the story with that all that stuff you did? It doesn't hold up, does it? Like, I mean, you know, the computer now can tell you all the answers. And I would say, well, I think it's okay, you know, but I don't know if anybody's actually worked all that stuff out with the programs. Even with the programs, you have to do rollouts. The programs can do rollouts very quickly, but, well, I'll get into that. And anyway, since no one had ever come out with a continuation of my researches or even a vetting of them, I decided in 2014 that it was time to see whether all the stuff that I'd done was right. And if it was right, to extend it a little more since no one else was doing it. So that's the genesis of the second volume. And although you say there were some relatively small corrections, that's true, but not really relevant to sort of the pure research kind of project that I had going. And, you know, the whole idea of this book was that it was supposed to work recursively. In other words, to solve the game backwards, the way you can do in chess. And I, being a chess player, knew that. I knew that the endgame books in chess start with the simplest positions, like a king and a pawn against a king. And then if you're playing, and let's say you have a king and a rook and a pawn, and the other guy has a king and a rook, you know that under certain circumstances, if you exchange the rooks, you'll get to the position with a king and pawn that's been proved to be a winning position. Or you'll avoid the exchange because you know that it would get to a drawn position as it's been proved. So that was my idea, to work backwards and to solve the simplest end games first and then move on to more complicated ones. So it turned out that when I actually did the work, it turned out that even the best programs that exist now, which are fantastically good, couldn't handle certain of the particularly odd endgame positions that came up. And so the work was like not 1,000% successful or foolproof even at this point. And I devote a whole chapter, it's called Chapter 6. It's Chapter 6 in the book on the question of how to play a one in a certain position. And it turns out that different levels of rollout are approach the correct answer, but that the current best thought that we have still gets completely confused in some of these positions, so that you're sort of back to go, you're sort of back to where I was in 1993. But at any rate, there's a lot of stuff that's much more concrete and that the bot handles much better. So it's just a matter of having some really solid information rather than the bunch of guesses that I made years ago, even though most of them were pretty good and some weren't. But the really bad mistakes I made were sort of in sub-variations that don't really come up that often. So that's the story of why I how that second volume came about.
Do you see any likelihood of a volume 3 on the subject?
That certainly would be a great project. I'm not sure that it's in my immediate to-do list. But generally, I mean, although, you know, some players complain that Volume 2 has very little practical value, it's still I haven't heard anyone say that anything in it was wrong. So, you know, it's my, my dad was a research scientist. So I'm sort of following in that, tradition, like by doing some pure research, which a lot of other backgammon, writers do, but, that was then.
Winner's guide for video poker, which is pretty obscure sometimes. Let's go to something that isn't so obscure. Let's go to the Backgammon Chronicles. In general, what are the Chronicles all about?
Well, the Chronicles are more or less the other side of the coin in the game until the end. In the Game Until the End is a purely technical backgammon book and a very technical one. But over the years, I had a great time playing backgammon all over the world, playing with different people, traveling. And just as I was surprised that no backgammon books came out that extended in the game until the end, it's even more surprising to me that over maybe the last 40 years, there have been no backgammon books that tell stories and that describe.
Well, actually, I mean, I want to say these are my favorite kinds of books where it combines stories with actual, you know, where you're learning something as well. But there was, you know, Jake wrote a book called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Four Point, which was exactly this kind of book that had stories of travels and things like that. So there have been some, you know, that have been out there, but as I say, I think those are the best kinds of books. You know, there's a fantastic book, classic poker book, called The Education of a Poker Player, which is this kind of thing as well. So, yeah, I thought these books were really enjoyable.
Right. Yeah. Sorry about that. Sorry about not mentioning Jake's book. I'm not sure it got the attention that it should have, at any rate. So the Chronicles is both my story and the story of backgammon over the last 30 or 40 years. And its subtitle is A Prose Adventures on Tour. And that's exactly what it is. It's like the inside baseball kind of story of what it's like to be on the road as a professional player, thinking about tournaments and how to, which ones to enter, how to arrange your life. And, you know, it's day-to-day information. But it also involves a lot of overview of the way backgammon evolved in the last 30 years. And most of the what I call the adventures took place in Europe from 2009 to 2018. Basically because the European backgammon scene was much superior to the American scene because they still had some sense of that backgammon was sort of an intuitive game and not they're not all scientists over there and people still like to gamble and they're nice resorts and so forth, where these tournaments took place. This was an era starting in around 2005 where the backgammon world was revived. The backgammon has gone through some big peaks and valleys over the last 40 years. It was super popular in the 70s, and you could play backgammon in every disco you went into in the late 70s. Hugh Hefner played, and James Bond played backgammon in some famous movies of his. But that sort of fad died down, and like by 2000, things were sort of not that vibrant anymore. But when poker came along and it was televised and everybody was excited about it, a lot of entrepreneurs decided that, wow, maybe we can do this with backgammon. And Europe became the scene. There was a World Series of backgammon. There were lots of challenge matches. There was online backgammon, which was a wonderful thing while it lasted. And the whole carnival. There was money flying around. People were taking meetings and arranging video projects. And that's the scene that I describe in volume one of the Backgammon Chronicles. And of course, Chronicles means a history. And it has a second meaning as far as my book is concerned, my books are concerned, because there was quite a famous backgammon player who was probably number one in the world for quite a while. His name's Mike Natanzin, and he was known by the moniker Falafel. And he was called Falafel because in his youth, he was very poor, excuse me, and the only nourishment he was able to afford were falafels. He was started out as a chess hustler, actually, in New York. He was a Russian-born Jew. But Falafel was a great gambler and a very principled gambler, too, in that he believed in gambling as a way of demonstrating your integrity. And he loved to gamble anyway. So what I would do in tournaments is when I got knocked out of the tournament, I'd gather together all the best players I could and show them the positions that had puzzled me and that had been my downfall sometimes in my matches. And whenever Falafel was there, he'd go, "Oh, Walkie, the Chronicles." He'd call these sessions that I'd arranged the Chronicles. And the Chronicles were the scene of a lot of pitched arguments and betting, a lot of betting that went on because the better a backgammon player it seems you are, or a player of any game, the more you think you know and the more you're willing to put your money where your mouth is. And Falafel was the centerpiece of all that. So I describe in a bunch of my essays the actual positions, and you know, part of the book itself is pure backgammon, is these interesting positions or puzzles that came up. But I also describe all the betting that went on and how Falafel imposed his overwhelming personality on these sessions. So he would call those quizzes they were like seminars almost, the Chronicles. And so that's the double meaning of the title of the book.
Now, an early chapter talks about chouettes. These are what I grew up on in the mid-70s through the early 1990s when I gave the game up totally. Are they still common these days? Is overall gambling at backgammon common these days?
The answer is no and no.
Okay, should I go on to the next question, or would you like to flesh that out a little bit?
I can talk for quite a while about chouettes. Chouette play let me just backtrack a little. Most competitive games are individual, and the ones that are team games are physical. But backgammon chouettes, the chouette is a structure that actually allows people to play on a team. And in certain formats of the chouette, the people on the team are allowed to advise one another and pool their collective knowledge. It turns out that this is an extremely gratifying and fun thing to do. It's a rare opportunity to sort of reason with other human beings or try to persuade them that of your beliefs, but also to learn from because every position has some feature that you're not aware of that other people see right away. Sometimes you're right, sometimes they're right. But in a chouette is structured like a kid's game of King of the Hill, where there's one player who plays against the team. The team has a captain. And if you're playing for money, which you always are in a chouette, the player who everyone is against is called the box, or the man in the box, I think is the original phrase that box was derived from. And that person is playing everyone. So if the stakes of the game are $20 a point, let's say, and the box is playing against five people, he's playing for $100 a point, whereas each team member is playing just for 20s. Well, this is a big rush if you're in the box, especially if you can win a few games in a row and have a quote unquote box run. It's very exciting, but it's also very dangerous because the people who you're playing against, their collective brain is probably going to be better than yours, smarter than yours, even though you might be a better player individually than all of them. And what happens in a chouette is once the box loses, the person who beat the box becomes the box. The box gets demoted to the back of the line of the team, there's an order of play, and the new captain is now in charge of the team's moves, and if that new captain wins, then he becomes the box. Now, Bob, I know that the chouettes that you participated in Los Angeles were not quite like that because
Non-consulting, usually.
They were non-consulting. And non-consulting chouettes means that the players on the team can't help the captain. And in fact, there are strict penalties that should be, even if they aren't in practice, imposed on those who do try by any means, including clearing their throat or mumbling a bit or shifting around uncomfortably to give a hint to the captain that the move he's about to make is not the best.
So I started out in Chicago, which was the opposite, where everything was consulting. Even before the cube was turned, you were allowed to consult. Which, if you're trying to learn the game, it's a much better option. Because you do get to hear all the discussion about why a move might be better or not or whatever.
Well, not only that, but you get this phenomenon where the really good players can no longer hide their knowledge. So, and not only that, but they have to make it really obvious and clear why the play they're advocating is correct, or else the captain won't listen to them. So it's a situation where they're actually pedagogically, obliged to break things down and make them clear. So it's even, it's a super learning experience if you can get in a game like that where there are really good players. You're going to know exactly what they think. They have to disclose their innermost thoughts pretty much if they want to persuade the captain. But in Los Angeles, which is sort of like, the West Coast was sort of do your own thing in the 70s when modern backgammon was developed, people didn't like to argue the way they do in New York. The New York chouettes that I used to play in whenever I'd get my butt there were 10, 12 people at a time. Bitchy, sarcastic, nasty, but accurate, you had to, sink or swim, and it was a brutal environment, but you could learn so much. In California, the chouettes were from the beginning completely non-consulting, so that your only decision when you're on the team is one of like handicapping. You're handicapping your captain against the box and trying to decide how badly your captain is going to butcher the game, so that maybe, but that's something you have to figure into the odds because you're not allowed to help. So it's very much like horse racing where there's a colt that doesn't run well in the mud, or that is in a bad mood, is not feeling well for some reason. Like, you can tell sometimes that the captain who you're betting along with is steaming or frustrated from the last game and is likely to screw this game up. So then you just head for the hills and avoid betting on him, get out of the game as soon as you can.
I wanted to go back to, you said that the chouette is not popular anymore, and that's just shocking to me. So it used to be that when you would go to backgammon tournaments, when you weren't playing in the tournament, there would be chouettes going on, which was a big part of it for professional players. Is that no longer the case?
And not only that, you would hope that you got knocked out of the tournament quickly so that you could get into a good chouette. And the chouettes would go on for 3 or 4 days all through the whole tournament.
That's not happening anymore?
It's not happening anymore, and it hasn't happened for the last 15 years or so.
Wow.
And the reason is that after the advent of the analysis programs, money play itself became a lot less popular because the programs not only told people their mistakes, but they gave them an error rating. And your error rating is like a badge of shame. The computer awards itself a zero error rating. And of course, we humans have positive error ratings, but the bigger your error rating, the worse you are. And once people saw that the person that they thought was about their level was playing at a 4 level and they were playing at a 14 level, they realized that the jig was up, you know, that they had no chance to win. So the analysis programs pretty much killed a lot of money backgammon. There's still some that exist, and there's still some chouettes in different places, but they're private, and there aren't as many suckers because they got wised up by the programs. And that led to tournament play becoming much more important to the backgammon community. Tournament backgammon is much harder than money backgammon because the moves you make and the doubling decisions you make always depend upon the score of the match. And they vary very much sometimes according to the score of the match. So there's a lot more science involved and a lot more, it's a lot more geeky because,
right.
You know, people have to know all this pretty esoteric stuff to successfully compete in tournaments. But the other thing that got lost when the programs took over was proposition play. Proposition
right.
play was the most spectacularly fun thing you could ever do in life, because you'd get into a dispute with somebody about what the right play was, what the right cube decision was, and they'd say, "Well, fuck you! You don't know what you don't know anything." And all of a sudden, they'd say you want to play it as a prop, which meant that you'd set the position up and you'd take turns. Like just a mini game would ensue where you start from that position every time, and one time you get to make your play, and you play the game out against your opponent, and then you turn the board around and he gets to make his play against you. In theory, at least, and most of the time in practice, that'll prove what the truth is. But the person who's betting on the wrong side of it can get annihilated very quickly. So these were really, really cutthroat sessions that before the computer programs came about could go on for days or weeks. And it was fascinating to watch because when you have two people who are really good players and who are really stubborn, the contest lasts for a long, long time until somebody finally gives up. But you get to see exactly why the one play is better than the other, because it's played out so many times. And that became completely extinct because all you have to do was consult the program and the program would tell you the right answer. So unless you could do it like spur of the moment where you know that your opponent didn't have a program to look at and you wouldn't let him leave the board, even to go to the bathroom because he might pull out his, you know, his notebook or his phone and look at the right answer. That was the extent to which you can do it to this day.
Yeah, you know, there was a passing mention in the book about a type of board, and I forgot the name of it, but I think it started with a V, where the board would record your moves, and then you would be able to actually download them into the program quite easily. And I just wondered, why aren't they using this for all tournaments? Because they are now live streaming finals matches and semifinals matches of big tournaments on the internet. I'm just surprised there isn't more widespread use of these boards.
Well, the board is not perfect. It has a flaw. It uses sensors, but if you don't sort of, for example, if you have a 6-1 to play, it can't tell whether you're playing the 6 first and the 1 next or the 1 first and the 6 next because you're not sort of bouncing on the, I guess you'd have to make the moves very, you know, without flying over certain, the, you know, the region. You, like if a pro makes a set, moves that seven, they'll just move it, from the, original location to the goal.
From the midpoint to
anyway,
the midpoint.
Anyway, those things don't, yeah, those things don't, it doesn't work as well. There's this guy, Jakub Goral. He's a Ukrainian. And I've played on his board, and it takes a long, long time because the board makes mistakes constantly. But there are projects and very good programmers who are very close to this, to creating a board that does it visually, that does it with a camera and that is able to speak directly to the program. But it's not, hasn't been perfected yet, and that's the reason that they don't exist in tournaments yet.
All right, before we continue talking to Bob Wachtel about his book, we're going to take a brief commercial break. We'll be right back.
The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. The South Point is currently closed due to the coronavirus, as are most of the casinos in the country. When it opens again, we will have their promotions for you. At predictit.org, there's a market where you can place small bets on the occurrence of various political events, mostly but not entirely in the United States. The most active markets now are who's going to be the nominees for the various elective posts and who the winners are going to be. You can still bet as to whether Hillary Clinton's going to enter the race or not, but I recommend you save your money. Gamblers with an Edge listeners receive a one-time offer of a deposit match up to $20 at predictit.org/promo/edge. You must play the money through once and cannot withdraw it for 30 days. Blackjack Apprenticeship is an excellent site for those of you who wish to be successful at counting cards at Blackjack. They have a variety of training programs. The April boot camp has been called off. There is a boot camp open May 30th through 31st where signups are now being accepted. Colin recently posted a Ask Me Almost Anything blog where one of the successful card counters who's made more than $1 million counting cards answers most questions. This is good for people looking for a variety of different ways to beat the casinos because every card counter does it a little bit different. The technique of counting cards is the same, but whatever their act is a little bit different, and this can be very useful information. A few of these are available for free, and if you become a membership of blackjackapprenticeship.com, there's a lot of these available at that point. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week, Spin Poker Deluxe. This pays the same as Spin Poker, which has 9 lines active, except the Spin Poker Deluxe version has 20 lines active, making it a 100 coins per play game. The EV and the strategy of the same is exactly the same as the single line version, although the variance is higher. When you are dealt a good hand and it gets multiplied by 20, that is a rare occurrence, but it makes a big difference when you do. Now let's go back to Bob Wachtel.
A few minutes ago, you said online poker, when it existed, was a great thing. So presumably that means
online
that backgammon. Yeah, it was a great thing. And you said it in a way that it no longer exists. Why does it not exist anymore?
Well, it doesn't exist for real money because people cheated. And the way they cheated was with these bots. And there was a site that I used to work for called Play 65 that was the most successful site in the late 2000s, 2000 to 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. And it got populated with bots. And the owners actually didn't know it. And what the guys who did this did was just install. It was, I mean, that site made it too easy to create new identities. These people, the bot masters, would create new identities, and they'd have their bots playing day and night at every end up to $100 a point. The bots never slept, and they played much better than humans. According to the bot masters, they programmed the bots so that they weren't perfect. First of all, because that would have meant it was easy to catch them. But secondly, because they claimed that these bots provided the customers with a lot of entertainment. Because if the customer plays at a 7 error rate and the bot plays at a 5 error rate, the bot's going to win the customer's money eventually, but the customer will put up a tough fight and have a good time, just like when you go into a casino. The casinos have found through trial and error that the right advantage for them to have is between 5% and 10%. If they have much more of an advantage than that, the customer doesn't win enough and doesn't get enough pleasure in the process of losing. But anyway, the bots were eventually, their existence was not suspected for a long time, but eventually it was discovered. By that time, they drained a lot of money from the backgammon community, and there wasn't that much to begin with. And the sites hold it up. Nowadays, there are there's a very nice site called Galaxy Backgammon, and they're trying to bring online play back, and they're hoping that the measures they can take can discover bots or humans using bots quickly enough so that they can keep the place pretty clean. But it's still in the beta stage, and it's been 10 years since there was any real online backgammon for money. But it was great fun. It was great fun because you could play anytime. You didn't have to leave the house. You could play somebody in another country. You could devise all kinds of different parameters for your game, you get paid right away. So it was a joy.
Yeah, the same problems happened with online poker, and I guess are still happening in the countries where you can still play online poker, but. Yeah, it's hard to prevent that online. And
there's a little bit of a difference because it's a little bit, they've had a little bit, it's been a little more work, let's put it that way, to create bots that play no limit hold'em or no pot limit PLO well enough to beat pretty good players.
Right. But limit, especially heads up limit hold'em was solved, and the guys who invented the bots that played that made tens of millions of dollars.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah. And it's funny because one of the essays that I write in the book investigates the different attitudes that poker players and backgammon players have toward using what I would call cheats. But in poker is sort of like not considered bad form. Sort of like if you can use a bot and get away with it, more power to you kind of thing. Everybody's trying to use as many devices as they can, including these ones that, you know, give you the history of all your opponents the minute you sit down, so you can see whether you're going to be sitting down at a good table or not. Or
right, yeah,
that give you perfect game theory optimal play with your hand as you're playing. And it doesn't have the same stigma that it does in backgammon. In backgammon, the only people who thought that what they did was okay were the guys who actually did it.
Right.
You know, their argument was that, oh, well, we're just providing liquidity. You know, like there's, might be somebody late at night who wants to play backgammon and there's nobody who wants to play them. Well, our bots are there and they're happy to play. And that actually would be okay if they'd disclosed that the bots were bots, but they didn't, you know. So, but their argument was that it was all for the best, the best for the community, that online backgammon was going to fail anyway because the rates were too high or whatever, for whatever reason. But, in poker, it doesn't have the same stigma.
And traditionally, even in live poker, there was cheating that 50 years ago, if you went into a poker room in Las Vegas at high levels, you were going to get cheated. And there's still some of that that goes on at the high levels of poker. So, they just seem to have a different attitude about cheating.
Well, backgammon has a curious history in that it evolved in the early 20th century and late 19th century as a quote unquote gentleman's game, and it was played a lot in bridge clubs, but very posh ones in London and Mayfair and in New York. There were these clubs called like the Regency and in New York that were very posh places where, it really, you had to be a citizen in good standing to be admitted, and where bad behavior wasn't tolerated. When I actually started playing money backgammon, There was still the convention that you didn't pay as you played. You would start a session. Let's say you're playing for $20 a point, and
those were high stakes back when you started playing.
What's that?
Those would have been high stakes back when you started playing.
Right, and you would play for 10 hours or something like that, and somebody would lose 70 points maybe, which was $1,400, and then you'd say, well, okay, and they'd say, well, I'll catch you later. and it was the kind of thing that was considered really actually uncouth and uncool to say, let's pay as we go. And people would object in the most strenuous way. What do you mean? You don't trust me. You're saying that I'm the kind of person, You think I'm the kind of person that would do that, but wouldn't pay? You should go talk to some, you know. Anyway, it wasn't like poker where, you know, the money has to be up and you have to put it in the pot. This led to a lot of bad experiences for some of us who wouldn't ever consider, you know, beating someone up or like, you know, doing anything, you know, nasty to get paid. So backgammon had a different sort of, image. That's, you know, part of why people were so offended at that these guys would take down the whole online enterprise.
We spoke about falafel. The person other than falafel most mentioned in the book, other than yourself, of course, was Mochi. Tell us about Mochi.
Well, Mochi is pretty much the person who single-handedly brought backgammon to Japan. And he's definitely like one of the few people who really, really, really is a professional. I mean, you have a lot of people who play backgammon who are good players, but he's the epitome of a tournament professional in that, his ambition is to bring his error rate to zero. And many, many, many hours of study are devoted to that goal. And Mochi became recognized a few years ago as clearly the best player in the world after many, many years of just constant improvement and work. And, you know, that's sort of typical of the Japanese mentality. They say that, you know, to get the best pizza in the world, you have to go to Tokyo. And same to get the best Hungarian goulash as well. Because, you know, the Japanese are such, so obsessive about perfecting, you know, whatever endeavor they get interested in. And Mochi certainly did that, but he also became a wonderful spokesperson for the game. He still travels. He did, and he still travels to wherever he can, and gives lectures and just participates in a lot of events. Always happy to share his experiences with people and. You know, it has a blog. So, but now there's some competition and it's his own students who look like they're about to eclipse him or maybe they have already. He's trained a few Japanese young men who are pretty terrific.
And woman.
What?
And woman.
Yeah.
And, he also has trained a young woman who's very good.
Yeah.
Akiko or something like that.
Yeah, Akiko's. Yeah, thanks. Right. Yeah, she got very good too. Although I don't know if she's exactly his protege, but he has a few that are really his own proteges. But the Japanese are wonderful backgammon players, just like the Danes. They're the two nations that have the best players and the most good players are Denmark and Japan. And it's basically because they have a lot of equanimity. Backgammon is an incredibly frustrating game. And if you're too passionate and too volatile, like, you know, you will lose your balance. And the Japanese are very serene, as are the Danes. The Danes are very cool and sort of scientific in a little different way, but that's a sine qua non. That's the, you know, an essential trait to being a great backgammon player is you cannot get, you know, kicked off your, get off tilt even for a second. It'll always cost you. And, you know, I guess in poker, it's the same too, but maybe you can survive, you know, a bit, but that's it. The Japanese and the Danes are the premier players. Germans also too, because they're very cool and calculating and scientific, and you know they just get on with things. Even if the worst possible horrible bad beats happen to them, they don't even think about it. They just go on, keep playing.
All right, Bob, we're going to have to wait until next week to hear about the Danes and the Germans. Can you come back and talk to us some more? We still have lots of questions for you.
I'd love to.
Perfect. That's the right answer. All right. So at the end of every show, Richard and I, have a recommended section. And if Bob has something to recommend as well, he's welcome to, but not required to. For my recommendation, it is going to be addressed the subject of what am I doing now that Las Vegas is shut down? The coronavirus has shut down much of the world, and you're advised to stay home as much as you can and socially isolate yourself. And a lot of my existence before, which included casinos in one, and also square dancing, and also Toastmasters, and also storytelling and improv, a lot of those had to do with other people. Those have all shut down. So now I am spending my time basically writing. I am trying to get way ahead on my weekly blog and considering subjects that I can write for possibly another book. And so I'm trying to use my time usefully. I'm not sure how successful I've been. I do get distracted. But since I'm spending so much time, more time at home now, that's what I'm doing, is using the time as usefully as I can. Richard, do you have anything to recommend?
Yeah, I just want to say you're mentioning that. I did something this week that for me was a lot of fun, and it was something called the Quarantine Playwriting Bake-Off. And it basically, it was a theater group that said, we're going to have this playwriting contest where you have 36 hours to write a play, no more than 15 pages, and at this time in the morning, we are going to send you 5 ingredients for your recipe that must be in your play. And so anyway, I participated, and they got 2,500 submissions, and they are going to pick a few of them to do a staged reading on YouTube of some of those plays. And anyway, for me, I also am trying to do more writing, and I do much better if I have a deadline, which this did. So anyway, now I can't recommend that because it's already over, although you may look for those kind of things. I'm sure more of these types of things will happen. But my recommendation is, I just finished a book called On Writing by Stephen King. And I realize not everybody is interested in writing. So, but if you are interested in writing, I thought it was a really good book. And I think Stephen King is a really good writer, even though I don't particularly like his genre. So I haven't read a lot of his books, but when the first time I did read one of his books, I was like, wow, this guy can really write. Anyway, so my recommendation is a book called On Writing by Stephen King.
So, I could add something. I would just like to observe that we're damn lucky that we have the internet. If this had all happened 20 years ago, life would really be boring staying at home. There's a lot you can do online. A lot of you can talk. You can you can play games. You can learn a lot. You know, you can read. It's much easier than, I mean, most people have some books around they can read, but you can do research. You can learn a lot. So
you can take classes.
Yeah, it's a lot better than
high level classes.
It would have been really hard. You really would have been, suffering from cabin fever if you'd 20 years ago, if you had to stay home. Now it's like what I like to do anyway, because I like to, do a lot of researching and all that sort of thing. But I want to ask you, Bob, aren't there some online gambling opportunities that you could pursue?
Well, in Nevada, there is definitely online poker.
But how about online video?
Not in Nevada.
Oh.
Not legally, anyway.
Yeah, not legally. And if there is some, I do not know how to play with an edge. If I can't find some kind of edge in the game, I would rather read a book. So I'm kind of finicky that way.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. I mean, sometimes they give bonuses and things, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And often
not in Nevada.
Oh, not in Nevada?
Well, not legally in Nevada. There are, here's the thing. There are online casinos that will still accept U.S. customers, but Nevada is one of the few states that made that illegal. So even some of these places that will accept U.S. customers won't accept them from Nevada.
Oh, wow. Just to protect their own, their own enterprise, right?
Well, they feel like in the future they may get, things may change in the U.S. and they want to avoid states that have specifically outlawed it. Now there are some that will still accept people in Nevada, but a lot of them also will not. And so,
you use a VPN?
You could use a VPN, but the problem is most of these online casinos now, the first time you cash out, they want to see a driver's license and a utility bill with your address matching the driver's license. So, you can't claim I live in Arizona and then suddenly your driver's license and utility bill are from Nevada.
You'd have to have a friend who, some other state. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's too bad.
All right. We could go on with this, and we're out of time. Hopefully, we'll be hearing Bob again next week. So until then, everybody, go out and hit lots of royal flushes. Good day.